This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
There was a big increase in the number of migrant children arriving in Italy last year, who either traveled alone or were separated from their relatives. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, says they're vulnerable to trafficking, exploitation, and abuse.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua reporting. Details coming up. Also, leading a West African delegation, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is in the Gambia today, hoping to end the political crisis there. And poverty and unemployment are blamed for the high level of human trafficking in Uganda. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari led a West African delegation to the Gambia today, trying to end the political crisis there. The Associated Press says Buhari has the authority to offer President Yahya Jammeh asylum if he steps down on January 19th, Inauguration Day. Jammeh is contesting the results of the December 1st election, in which opposition leader Adama Barrow was declared the winner. He is refusing to step down and has appealed to the country's Supreme Court, but the court lacks judges and it may not hear the case until May. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, could intervene militarily. The Associated Press reports that a Nigerian army memo orders officers to prepare a battalion of 800 troops for possible deployment in the Gambia. The memo, dated yesterday, is signed by Army Chief of Staff General Tukur Buratai. Also, Reuters reports the African Union will no longer recognize Jammeh as president if he does not step down on January 19th. The AU Peace and Security Council warns of serious consequences if Jammeh's actions lead to political disorder or a humanitarian and human rights crisis, including loss of life. Jammeh has been in power since 1994 after staging a coup. As South Sudan's civil war enters its fourth year and the space for dialogue shrinks inside the country, some activists abroad are looking for new solutions to achieve peace. From Nairobi, Jason Patnikin reports on two such initiatives.
A leading South Sudanese dissident has called for all opposition groups to come together to chart a new way forward to end the country's seemingly endless civil war. More than 2 years of internationally backed talks have failed to achieve peace between the government and the main rebel group known as SPLA-IO. Tens of thousands of people have been killed and over 1 million others have fled the country as the government, the rebels, and various militia groups battle each other. Joseph Bangasi Bakasoro, a former governor, launched the South Sudan National Movement for Change this month so all armed and unarmed opposition groups can reach consensus on how to negotiate with the government. Bakasoro spoke to VOA from exile in the United States.
The issue of South Sudan is not only the IO and the government, but there are so many actors there who need to be part of the discussion. And we need this time to bring all of them together so that when we broker the peace, it will be a lasting peace in South Sudan without leaving anyone outside the process of negotiation.
President Salva Kiir's regime held Bakasoro as a political prisoner for 4 months in 2015 and 2016 before releasing him. Bakasoro says it is not safe for opposition members to meet in South Sudan.
Nobody can talk freely now in South Sudan. We need a dialogue that can bring everybody on board, but in a neutral zone, so that we discuss the reality of the problem of South Sudan.
Bakasoro said he favors nonviolence, although some opposition groups want forceful regime change.
We need to use negotiation as a priority because so many South Sudanese have died, have been killed in war. We need to use that peaceful approach.
Bakasoro's call for opposition unity comes after President Salva Kiir launched his own national dialogue process in Juba. SPLA-IO leader Riek Machar has criticized Kiir's dialogue as only including pro-government voices. South Sudanese church groups have voiced similar concerns. Bakasoro said Kiir's dialogue is not genuine.
It is just a one-sided dialogue. That means you are discussing with yourself. The government is arming the front line, fighting in the field, and at the same time calling for national dialogue.
Bakasoro is not the only one proposing alternatives from outside South Sudan. A group of 30 South Sudanese youth leaders, including government and opposition supporters, met this week in Nairobi to try to chart a new way forward. Peter Biarajak, who organized the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, said they could not safely hold the event inside South Sudan.
Many youth of South Sudan do not feel well represented by all the different parties. Even those who come from Juba, those who come from rebel held areas, they feel that they have been trapped into a box that does not represent the aspirations.
Participant Agiedo Adwak said that although the youth leaders came from different tribes and political beliefs, they spoke their minds and peacefully got to know each other.
You've had diverse views, very strong views, but I have to say that we've been able to put aside our differences. I mean, we're not fighting, we're not killing ourselves, we're expressing ourselves. That's definitely an advantage.
As the war drags on in South Sudan, such alternative approaches may be the country's best chance at finding new paths to peace. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Italian government has reached an agreement with the Catholic Church and local charity organization to create a humanitarian corridor for Eritrean, Somali, and South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. The corridor will pave the way for a legitimate path to citizenship for refugees who enter Italy. From Rome, reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis on what this means for migrants and refugees who want a new life in Italy.
The Italian government has signed an agreement with the Catholic Church, the Italian Bishops' Conference, and a charitable organization called the Community of Sant'Egidio to support what they call a humanitarian corridor, creating a safe space which will allow vulnerable migrants to come to Italy legally and avoid that treacherous voyage across the Mediterranean. Now, this announcement is in conjunction with the World Day of Migrants and Refugees, which will take place on Sunday. And around 500 vulnerable migrants from the Sudan, Eritrea, and Somalia, who are currently in refugee camps in Ethiopia in very difficult situations, will be eligible for special visas that will allow them to travel legally to Italy.
Is this a one-time thing that will be done, or will this be an ongoing program?
Well, this is a project that was actually founded in December 2015 and by the community of Sant'Egidio, and that has allowed several hundred refugees to travel to Italy, most of them Syrian, and special arrangements were made in countries including Morocco, Lebanon, and Ethiopia to allow this to take place. So this is the continuation and an exciting new development in something that already exists, offering humanitarian visas with limited validity and covering the costs of these voyages to allow migrants to have a safe passage and create a new life for themselves.
If you could tell us then, what exactly will they be offered when they do come to Italy?
Well, when they arrive in Italy, these refugees will be able to take part in an integration program, which will include Italian language lessons. They'll have assistance in helping them finding a job and also school enrollment for their children. So this is really a great development for many of those refugees who are struggling in migrant camps in Ethiopia at the moment.
And also, I understand that there were several hundred migrants who were rescued off the Mediterranean yesterday. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the number of refugees making that voyage across the Mediterranean has dropped significantly in January, but around 800 were rescued in several operations off the coast of Libya on Thursday.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Rome. There was a big increase in the number of migrant children arriving in Italy last year who either traveled alone or were separated from their relatives. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, says they're vulnerable to trafficking, exploitation, and abuse. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The migrant children made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean Sea. They were at the mercy of smugglers and traveled aboard overcrowded boats or flimsy rubber dinghies. Tough enough to do with an adult, frightening and even more dangerous when traveling alone. UNICEF spokesperson Sarah Crowe says the figures for 2016 show an alarming trend.
We've seen in 2016 a doubling of the number of unaccompanied and separated children who've arrived in Italy. So compared to 2015, where we saw just over 12,000, in 2016 we saw 25,800 unaccompanied and separated children who've arrived from several different African countries. Primarily amongst the top four are Eritrea, Egypt, the Gambia, and Nigeria.
Most of the unaccompanied migrant children are between 15 and 17 years old. Some are younger. Crow says they face danger from the beginning of their journey.
Starting from their countries of origin, they just face the most extraordinary hardship at every step of the way. Many are fleeing persecution, conflict, deprivation, and they go through a system of what is known as pay-as-you-go. So they pay often in labor, and we've seen, for instance, girls at very high risk of sexual exploitation and abuse, including sexual exploitation by criminal gangs.
Several migrant girls told UNICEF they were forced into prostitution in Libya to pay the cost of traveling across the Mediterranean. It's wrong to assume that their problems are over once they arrive in Italy. Crow says they're lured to Europe with a promise of a better life or education. But processing their asylum claims takes months, even years.
So very often they simply take matters into their own hands. They leave the centers where they're being cared for, and they keep going to various parts of Europe, sometimes looking for relatives, and this exposes them to another level of danger and risk.
UNICEF recommends several steps to help protect migrant and refugee children. First, efforts must be made to protect them from abuse and exploitation before they arrive in Italy or Greece. Next, it says keeping families together is the best way to protect kids and give them legal status. And once they arrive in Europe, they should be given health and education services. What's more, UNICEF says they must be protected against xenophobia, discrimination, and marginalization. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Uganda is one of many developing countries that has high levels of human trafficking. The problem is blamed on poverty and unemployment. It's seen many youths, especially girls, end up in slavery or prostitution in the Middle East. From Kampala, Catherine Nambi has the details on increasing human trafficking in Uganda and the steps being taken to prevent it.
Prosi Nabukela, a 25-year-old, is one of the estimated 250 Ugandans that annually end up stranded abroad with human trafficking rings, according to a Uganda police report. Majority of these have been trafficked to the Middle East with promises of better jobs and hope of escaping Uganda's high unemployment and biting poverty, but are instead subjected to hard labor and prostitution. Prosi's ordeal is not one to easily narrate without breaking down.
We realized that there were couples at the reception with children as if they were waiting. Sami told us that those were the people who were going to take us. That's why you are here and you are going to work as housemaid. Then most of us were like, no, we cannot work as housemaids because we have our papers and we did come here to work as housemaid. He said, no, I bought you from Uganda veterans to come and work like maid. I paid money for you to come and work as housemaid. He said he had bought us at $3,500 each. I bought you with my money. If you don't want to work, pay my money, $3,500 here, and give me money for the ticket. I take you direct to the airport. Then we said, no, we are not going to work and we don't have the money to pay.
Unfortunately, many other youths are falling prey as licensed and unlicensed companies and employment agencies continue to recruit Ugandans to work as security guards, laborers, and drivers in the Middle East. Moses Binoga, a Uganda police commissioner in charge of anti-trafficking, says most of the youths are from the urban centers, with majority from Uganda's capital, Kampala.
Kampala has the largest share, and all of the surrounding districts of Kampala. That's where they are convincing youth, and they are being taken out for promised jobs, which are not there.
He says even after the Uganda government ban on the export of housemaids, there are still some companies illegally in the trade, and warned Ugandan girls to be extra cautious with such jobs.
This ban is still on. The government is trying to work out with the other governments to make it safe for Ugandans to go and work such a type of job. Those ones who are risking to go now, they will continue suffering because the cries are still going on. Cries of youths who are going to especially Middle East for jobs of housemaid, the cries of mistreatment, cries of being forced to work while sick, cries of being overworked with no increase in salary are still high, and sometimes sexual abuse by the bosses. And the government is trying to reach a compromise with those governments and so that our Ugandans can no longer face such problems.
Uganda's State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Okello Oryem, has challenged all Ugandans seeking employment abroad to do due diligence lest they fall into the trap of human traffickers.
Today, you can easily go on the internet and download information on any company around the world or on any individual around the world. And that a simple research by an individual will establish for you whether that company exists or that company does not exist. So the burden is also upon individuals not to become so gullible, but also they have a responsibility to do some due diligence on their part before they jump onto the plane and travel abroad.
But why do human traffickers find safe haven in Uganda despite the existence of an anti-trafficking law? Could the law be lenient, or is it not implemented to its fullest? Agnes Igoye is the Deputy National Coordinator in the Uganda Anti-Trafficking Task Force.
They established our own law in 2009, the Prevention of Trafficking Persons Act, which criminalizes this. So it does mainly four things. It helps us prevent the crime. That's why you see awareness is very critical. Giving us that law and putting the task force in place where we collaborate with different stakeholders, you know, that giving us, you know, that ground. I know trafficking is not just a Ugandan problem.
According to the United Nations, the government of Uganda does not fully meet the minimum standards for the elimination of trafficking. However, it is making significant efforts to do so. Prosina Bukela, who has helped escape from Saudi Arabia and return to Uganda, is currently employed as a secretary with one of the big corporations and advises fellow youths to go slow with promises of jobs abroad.
I would like to tell Ugandans that much as we are desperate and much as we are poor, our country is poor, think twice before you go to work abroad. Someone will deceive you that you're going to be a teacher, you're going to be a salesperson, and will just sell you off to a country where you cannot even read a signpost that maybe this word means police. Everything is written in Arabic, so they should think twice before they go.
For VOA, this is Catherine Nambi reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The daughter of Angola's longtime president recently took over a major bank and embarked on plans to restructure the state-owned oil company. The moves have raised eyebrows over the family's plans as her father prepares to step down later this year. From Johannesburg, Anita Powell takes a closer look at Isabel dos Santos's and what the future holds for Angola's longest-serving first family.
As Angola's notoriously media-shy president prepares to step down after nearly four decades in power, all eyes in this southern African nation are looking not at José Eduardo dos Santos, but at his billionaire daughter. Though flush with oil, Angola is one of the most unequal societies in the world, a point that dos Santos's critics bring up often.
She's stealing from the state. It's plundering the state. And it does not improve the lot of Angolans. It basically impoverishes the country further, because this is money that should have been applied in other projects for the benefit of the country and not one person.
That's Rafael Marquez, a prominent journalist and anti-corruption campaigner who was one of Isabel dos Santos's fiercest critics. Marquez has sued her in a Portuguese court, alleging that she launched a public smear campaign against him over his reporting on her business empire. Dos Santos has accused her critics of playing politics and says she came by her immense wealth through hard work and professional competence. Forbes ranks her as Africa's richest woman. However, in late 2015, watchdog group Transparency International ranked her among the world's 15 most corrupt people and institutions. Alex Vines, Africa director at the London-based think tank Chatham House, says there is some merit to her argument. He says the state oil company, Sonangol, needs the reforms dos Santos is proposing in order to bring down costs.
She's a business lady. For whatever you think about her having got the job, because possibly she was the president's daughter, there is an effectiveness in the reform process that you have to give her credit for.
Repeated calls to the media department of Sonangol for comment went unanswered. The oil company's website is flush with examples of how the company has reached out to the community with new roads, clinics, and housing developments. Other African leaders have appointed children and close relatives to top positions in government, raising speculation that they're being groomed to take over. This has been seen most recently in Uganda, where the president named his son, a 42-year-old two-star general, as a special presidential advisor. And in Equatorial Guinea, Africa's longest-serving president has made his choice of successor explicitly clear by naming one of his sons as vice president. But Vine says this future is not likely or even possible for Isabel dos Santos, who was born in the former Soviet Union to the president's Russian-born first wife.
Firstly, Isabel dos Santos is born outside of Angola. Constitutionally in Angola, you can only run for president if you're born in the country. Secondly, race politics plays a role in Angola. The MPLA has a history of drawing from black Angolans for its presidency. And that politics is still very much alive and well in Angola.
Instead, both Vines and Marquez agree, her industriousness is part of a plan to provide for her family in a post-presidential era. Another sign of this could be that President dos Santos has also appointed one of his sons to chair the nation's sovereign wealth fund, worth an estimated $5 billion. If President dos Santos does follow through on his pledge to step down this year, it appears the longtime first family will be well cared for. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rashad Smith, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
On Friday, January 20th, the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, will be sworn into office. VOA will be there and will broadcast the presidential inauguration live from 1600 UTC to 1800 UTC to audiences around the world. Tune in as we begin the next chapter in American history, right here on VOA.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.